I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Hundreds of thousands of anti-government demonstrators have taken to the streets in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, in the last few weeks. The protesters are responding to a decision by President Yanukovych to cancel a trade deal with the European Union. Ukraine sits on the dividing line between Europe and Russia, with whom it has had a complicated relationship. The president's actions have been criticized for being too pro-Putin, and now there are calls to bring down the government. We begin our conversation in this hour of Radio Times with Corey Flintoff, Moscow correspondent for NPR. He's been reporting from Ukraine, in fact, joins us from Ukraine. And Corey Flintoff, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning. What happened last night in Kiev?
Well, last night in Kiev at about 1 o'clock in the morning, we started hearing that riot police were being deployed around the edges of the central square here, the Maidan. So we went down there, and the first thing we saw were just, I'd call them phalanxes of riot police. You know, they wear these plastic black bubble helmets, and they carry metal shields that are probably about 4 feet high. And there must have been, on the first corner we came to, there must have been probably 300 to 400 of these guys. And the way they deploy them is they pack them very closely together in ranks of, 4 or 5 deep. They surround the whole rank with their shields. And these guys are standing there, and they look very menacing, And actually, when you get up close to them, you see them. In fact, they're young men who look like, ordinary young soldiers you'd see anywhere. But in fact, when you see a whole group of them in their full armor, they look quite menacing. And people in the protest encampment were really, really worried. They were gathering. They were passing out their version of the armor, which were these plastic hard hats, orange plastic hard hats. And if you saw any of the video from last night's encounters, what you saw was, the sort of group of black helmets faced up against a group of orange helmets. People were actually sort of fabricating armor for themselves. I saw guys taping pieces of firewood to their forearms as a way of kind of what they thought would be a way to fend off police truncheons. So this went on for about 3 hours. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I should add, of course, that it's very cold. At this point, it was a few degrees below freezing, but we had a fresh snow, and so there was snow and kind of frozen slush and ice all over the place, and which makes it a very slippery and sort of a very dangerous surface. The police started to move in, and so throughout the night, there was this kind of push-pull going back and forth. The police actually managed to tear down some barricades. They tore down some tents. Supposedly there were some people injured, although we did not see that. We understand that there were some arrests, but not very many. But anyway, what you did see were these groups of protesters and police pressed against each other. The police would line up their shields, and they just start moving forward in this kind of inexorable way, kind of just pushing everything before them. Surprisingly, the protesters were able to stand up to that. Big groups of protesters pushed back, and this whole thing, it didn't really break until after dawn, really, and it wasn't until about 10 o'clock in the morning that the police finally gave up.
Wow.
They hadn't seen it. I think probably for them the calculation is, do you turn to some more violent tactics? Do you start having people beat up protesters? Or do you finally just fade away? And so what they did was finally move their people back out to their buses, and they drove away.
So do you think, and of course, Corey, there have been protests over the last couple of weeks, especially in Kiev. Do you see what happened last night as energizing the protesters who are protesting the government in Ukraine?
Absolutely, Marty. That's just what seems to have happened. We were walking around the protest encampment just a short while ago, and the people who got through the night, they look pretty tired, obviously, but they're jubilant and happy. One of the features of this protest is that there's a big stage, like a like a rock show soundstage that's been built in the middle of the square, and there's been a steady stream of politicians and musical groups that you know, either rally or entertain the protesters. And there was a lot of really lively music on there, and a lot of speakers who were really calling this a kind of a victory. They say they feel that they basically faced down the powers that be. There was a steady flow of new people coming into the square. I heard some estimates in the sort of 25,000 numbers, and I think it could fairly be said at least that it was in the tens of thousands.
Does this tent city, does it look like the Occupy that we might recognize that happened in the United States a couple of years ago?
It's a bit better organized, to tell you the truth.
Is it?
And this is because, you know, Ukrainians have a lot of experience with this. You know, in 2004, they had the Orange Revolution, which involved having people occupy this very same spot. And they went on at it for weeks in the middle of the winter of 2004, gathering enough sort of public momentum to force a rerun of an election that was tainted by fraud. And the person who would have been elected president at that time was Viktor Yanukovych, the very man who is currently the president. So he lost to a successful protest in the square, and I think his calculation may be that he couldn't afford to lose again. So that may be why they took the big risk of bringing out the police last night.
And I'm curious about why this trade deal has been so important to the people of Ukraine.
You know, people see it as a question of moving the country either to the west toward Europe and sort of European democratic values, or to the east toward Russia and toward what people see as the sort of autocratic system that President Vladimir Putin has put into place. So, economically, Ukraine these days probably does belong more to the east. Its economy is rather outmoded. Its industries need modernization very badly. They need foreign investment. They're not very competitive by European standards. But on the other hand, I would say that based on at least what I've seen and the people I've talked to, the spirit of the country is generally more pro-West and pro-European, and that's certainly what you hear from the people here. So there was a long process underway. It took about 5 years of negotiations to get Ukraine to the point where it was ready to sign what they called an association agreement and a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement with the European Union. Viktor Yanukovych said repeatedly that that's what he favored, that was the direction he wanted to take the country in, but there was one condition that he just could not stomach, and that was that the European Union countries wanted him to release his most bitter political rival, that's Yulia Tymoshenko. And you may remember Yulia Tymoshenko from the 2004 Orange Revolution. She is that beautiful blonde woman who always wore her long blonde hair in a braid curled around her head, sort of like a tiara. She is currently in prison. As soon as President Yanukovych was elected in 2010, they began proceedings against Yulia Tymoshenko, who had been the prime minister. And they charged her with abuse of office. And in what many countries, and especially members of the European Union, consider to have been a politically motivated revenge trial, she was sentenced to 7 years in prison. She's already served two. So the European Union countries were demanding that she be released and that she be pardoned. But if she were released and pardoned, that would free her to run against President Yanukovych in the 2015 presidential election. And polls were showing that she had a very good chance of beating him.
A couple of days ago, a statue of Lenin was pulled down, and it looks like practically pulverized. Was that a spontaneous action on the part of the protesters? Should we read something into this, Corey?
Well, you know, that was something that actually, I believe it shows the fault of our media coverage. The incident in which the Lenin statue was pulled down took place about a half mile away from where this main protest is. And my understanding that it was carried out by a fairly small group of right-wing nationalists who, you know, hate any symbol of communism and want to destroy it, and that it had nothing to do with the main protest. In fact, some of the protest organizers condemned the action, not because it was Lenin or because it was communism, but because it was vandalism. So they, you know, the main protest organizers don't want to be seen as destroying anything if they can help it. They want to be seen as a big, peaceful people's protest movement. So the Lenin statue was kind of a sideshow, but it was something that made for pretty spectacular TV footage, and that's what a lot of the international media focused on. The same is true of the violent protests in front of the presidential administration building that took place on the 1st of December. There was very vivid TV footage of people driving a big front-end loader into a police line, and then, you know, very, very aggressive so-called protesters attacking the young policeman. That apparently is a provocation that was carried out by people unknown, but people believed to have been associated with the government, a way of making spectacular TV footage, driving up casualties among the police, and just generally making the protest look bad. And because it made vivid TV and very dramatic footage, it was shown over and over again. So both those incidents are examples of the way our media tends to be selective and not very careful about the nuances of these protest things.
We have to say goodbye to you in about 45 seconds. I don't know if there's a quick answer to this. Why does the EU want Ukraine? What is the EU's interest in Ukraine, as you describe a country that still has some pretty serious economic problems?
Yes, it is. You know, Ukraine is not the great economic prize that it might appear to be. It does have 46 million people. It was once the breadbasket of Europe, I mean, and the Soviet Union. So it's a very promising agricultural country. It has a lot of mineral resources. It has a huge market for consumers that's just opening up. But it also is an economic basket case. Mm. And that's why Europeans were a little bit hesitant to offer the sort of financial incentives that might have made Yanukovych and his government more interested in joining.
Well, Corey Flintoff, we called you up early this morning. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It was my pleasure.
And he's Moscow correspondent for NPR, has been reporting from Ukraine. We will continue our conversation talking about some of the confrontations in Ukraine. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Enchantment Theater Company supports WHYY and presents its new production, Aladdin and Other Enchanting Tales. Aladdin discovers a genie's lamp in a hidden cave. Sinbad sails to distant lands where he rescues an enchanted bird. The Kalandar Prince battles a fiery dragon. Aladdin and Other Enchanting Tales, December 17th through the 30th at Arts Bank Theater on the Avenue of the Arts in Philadelphia. Giant puppets, spellbinding magic, and enchanting music. Ticket information at enchantmenttheater.org.
This week in This American Life, you think you know what it might be like to have an autistic son, but you don't know. 12 years old, 250 pounds.
Just gets out of his seatbelt, takes his clothes off, pees in my car, poops in my car. My son Jake starts to gag. The dog's in there. I'm trying to prevent her from eating it. We're driving down the Edens. We get
stories of kids and the parents who still love them, no matter what.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, President Obama is on a public relations campaign to convince Americans, especially young ones, that healthcare.gov glitches are fixed. But is it enough to make the uninsured sign up? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskow, and just to recap, Ukraine is in turmoil after its president, Yanukovych, decided against a trade agreement with the European Union. There have been large street protests in Kiev and confrontations with the police. We just said goodbye to Corey Flintoff, Moscow correspondent for NPR, who gave us an update on what's been happening in Kiev and Ukraine as well. Joining us now is Mark Lawrence Schrod. He's assistant professor of political science at Villanova University. His research specializes in the politics and foreign policy of former Soviet states. Also the author of a book that will be published next year called Vodka Politics, Alcohol, Autocracy, and the Secret History of the Russian State. And Mark Lawrence Schrod, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I know you were listening in as Corey Flintoff was describing what has been happening in Kiev. And I was thinking back to the Orange Revolution of 2004. Do you see some roots between what's happening today and what happened almost a decade ago?
There are a lot of parallels, but I sort of caution buying too much into those parallels. Yes, you have mass protests. Yes, they're also happening in frigid cold weather. Yes, they happen to be against the same guy, but in terms of Viktor Yanukovych. But what we had with the Orange Revolution was sort of this wave of color revolutions, and they all seemed to follow the same sort of pattern that you would have an election, it would be fraudulent, you would have some degree of free media sort of highlighting the voter irregularities, and then you'd have mass protests. You saw this with the Orange Revolution in Georgia in 2003, and then obviously the Rose Revolution in Georgia, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, the Tulip Revolution in Kyrgyzstan, all follow that same sort of blueprint. But what we have here is a similar sort of uprising, as it were, or protest movement. But it doesn't really seem to have anything to do with the electoral politics. Mm. It doesn't have to do with the electoral fraud. But people are starting to make it more and more about some of these other base issues about corruption in the government, as well as the choice as to which way Ukraine's going to lean, whether it's towards the European Union or towards Russia.
Well, and as Corey had told us, and as if anyone's been following this, President Viktor Yanukovych had been in support of this trade agreement with the EU, except for this very particular sticking point. And why is she so significant in terms of our understanding of Ukrainian politics?
Well, there's a long history of animosity between Viktor Yanukovych and Yulia Tymoshenko, who is sort of the more Western-leaning, candidate, or has been in Ukrainian politics for the last decade or so. And so there's been a lot of animosity, partly because of the complexities of the Ukrainian political system, where you have a president, you have a prime minister who is also very important, the semi-presidential, kind of semi-parliamentary system, where all of them have some degree of leverage over each other. And in the Ukrainian situation, this has just kind of devolved into, I don't say chaos, but gridlock, I suppose, is a better way of pointing it. So there have been a lot of intense rivalries between Yanukovych, which is, he tends to be on the more eastern, represents the more eastern parts of Ukraine.
The kind
more
of looking Russian to speaking. Russia.
Yeah, and definitely more aligned with Russia. Tymoshenko, is her block of support is more in the east, the parts of Ukraine that used to be part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth back in the day, or the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and don't have they tend to speak Ukrainian as opposed to Russian, and don't see themselves as being aligned with Russia and more with Europe.
But there, she's not the only political leader that sits in a prison in Ukraine.
She's probably the most well-known one. There are certainly others, but she did have. She made quite a bit of money even before achieving sort of national political prominence. But why she's sitting in a prison now is a deal that was made in 2009 between the Ukrainian government and Gazprom, which is the Russian natural gas conglomerate, or sort of the economic wing of Russian foreign policy that holds quite a bit of sway over Ukraine, as Ukraine is very heavily reliant on imports of heavily subsidized Russian natural gas and oil.
Do you see, though, Ukraine then caught between Russia, you know, its mother, I guess, some former mother Russia, and Europe and the EU?
Yeah.
And maybe even geographically caught between these two parts of Europe?
I think so. And it's an interesting – I was trying to figure out ways to try and explain this because it is incredibly complex.
Right.
But I was thinking on the way down here that it's almost like, Ukraine is in one of these kind of borderline communities between sort of the gated community to the east that they would really like to be a part of, and then the other community to the I guess on the Russian side, where I don't want to say bad things about Russia, but there's some corruption, some shady dealings going on there. And of course, it would like to join sort of the gated community in the West with Europe, but it seems to have a lot of, reliance on Russian oil, natural gas, and other other aspects. Plus, it's also, I guess, the precipitating factor right now is that Ukraine is in one heck of a economic crisis as well. And so, I think a lot of what you see with this decision to sort of renege on this European agreement is not sort of the machinations of Kremlin politics so much as it is sort of a short-term economic decision that, Ukraine needs help.
You want to grab a little water there?
Sure.
Why don't we do that, and I'll quickly reintroduce you. And that's Mark Lawrence Schrod, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Villanova University. We're talking about what's happening in Ukraine, and we are also opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. So caught between these two forces.
Right, right. And the precipitating problem is that it's got a short-term debt problem, and it's becoming quickly a crisis. And the fact that there's a great amount of instability in the streets of Kiev makes it even a more risky investment for foreign investors looking to put their money somewhere. So this is increasing the cost of sort of insuring Ukrainian debt so that it doesn't default. And so this is sort of exacerbating the economic problems. And so it seems that Yanukovych is essentially trying to just make it through, and weather this particular storm. A lot of people are suggesting that he's just looking forward to the 2015 elections. That's the next round of presidential elections. He would like to run again. He would like to win. But that's not going to go over too particularly well if the economy goes down the toilet. And that's what I think a lot of, very practically speaking, what they saw with this accession agreement is that it did absolutely nothing to help Ukraine out in essentially getting over that hump to 2015. May be really great for long-term prospects, not so good in the short term.
And do you think Yanukovych fears Vladimir Putin? Fears the power that Russia has over Ukraine?
I don't think so. A lot of people, again, suggest that, and this is another thing that kind of gets me about sort of Western media coverage of this area is this sort of boogeyman mentality that Putin is sort of the puppet master of all that goes on over in these areas. I think it has more to do with sort of domestic politics within Ukraine, within Yanukovych, and I don't think Yanukovych is particularly beholden to Putin. I think he's more beholden to his own sort of group of oligarchs and making sure that his guys in sort of the eastern part of Ukraine, they're getting theirs, and that he maintains his electoral support going towards 2015.
How do you see the relationship, or is there a relationship between Ukraine and the United States? The White House said earlier this week, or perhaps even last week, violence has no place in a democratic society, incompatible with our strategic relationship. Secretary of State Kerry used the word disgust over the use of force, saying that this is not what democracies do. How do you see this relationship between these two countries?
It's interesting. There's been a long sort of history of the United States in Ukraine and Georgia as well. I think these two kind of get lumped together, these post-Soviet republics that are both rather leery of their large neighbor in Russia and have been working tirelessly to get as far away from Russia as they possibly can. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they can't just sort of pick up and move.
No.
But trying to integrate with Western institutions, trying to work on these pathways first to NATO, and that they're not members of NATO, but sort of on that path as well, and then towards the European Union as well. And I think that's in the broader scheme of things where this whole association agreement kind of came in. It was seen as being another step in that path. It wasn't an agreement on accession to the European Union. It wasn't like they're going to be swept in anytime soon, but it was, again, sort of steady progress.
Right. A first step towards a possible more formal agreement.
Right. And so there's been sort of a Ukrainians tend to be very look very positively on the United States, as do Georgians, and you know, we have a lot of you know, sort of representatives there as well. And so there's a, I guess, some very strong relations, and I believe, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but you know, Ukraine has been one of the top receivers of U.S. foreign aid. It has, and so you know, we're on fairly good relations, and I think we want to see Ukraine be stable, and obviously. Strive for not only economic prosperity, but you know, democratization and sort of alleviation of a lot of the corrupt influences that are currently in Ukrainian politics.
And I wonder whether there's a risk of the United States sort of being between the American, the Ukrainian people and their government.
Yeah, and I think the United States so far has, aside from you know, these announcements from Vice President Biden and from Secretary of State Kennedy, John Kerry. Has been sort of laying low on this, and I think is probably a wise tactic. There's, you know, not much that the United States can do at this point. It seems to be more about the European Union than it does the United States, and I think just making sort of brash proclamations or brash initiatives is just going to stir up things, not only in Ukraine, but also there's a large contingent of the Russian population in Russia that sees... that sees the United States, sees first Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and now John Kerry as sort of being the puppet master between anything that is going on in these territories. They blame it on you know, sort of American meddling in oftentimes. So so I think just sort of laying low and letting the Ukrainians decide what the Ukrainians are going to do is probably the, you know, the most prudent choice at this point.
Let me get looks like Mary from Mount Airy to join us on Radio Times. And Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm a Ukrainian-American. I'm the daughter of a post-World War II refugees from Ukraine, and we in Philadelphia have been organizing support actions for what's going on in Ukraine, especially opposing the violence. I myself have close relatives that have been on the streets in the protests, and we're very concerned about what's happening. The other point I wanted to make was that the EU agreement is really just the spark that lit the flame. I mean, we have to really think about the bigger context of decades of repression and murder and corruption and poverty and isolation that the Ukrainian people have had to deal with. And this is why hundreds of thousands of people have been moved to stay in sub-freezing weather for more than 2 weeks now. I think that's something that we really have to think about. It's not just the EU, but the bigger picture that people do not want to be dragged back into that Stalinist past.
Mary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'd be curious, Mark, your response. As she said, this was really the spark that got people to the street for some larger issues, probably.
Right, and that's something that we've seen as these protests have progressed. First, it was about the European agreement. Now it seems to have taken on more of an anti-Yanukovych and sort of anti-Russian or an anti-corruption angle to it. And so I think that really does resonate with what you're seeing even in the associated protests in the United States and I guess throughout Ukraine as well. And so this is kind of the boiling over of bigger issues because I think if you get down to the actual economics of the agreement, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. But now it's been sort of imbibed with all of this, I guess, these grander visions of making a stark choice between either Europe or Russia. And these are very, I guess, emotional and visceral issues. And so it does, you know, go back quite a long time. And so there's a lot of I guess, historical material to draw from as well.
Mary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. Again, talking about the conflicts, the anti-government protesters in Ukraine, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Mark, you were telling me before we went on the air about the kind of potential, I guess, that Ukraine has in terms of natural resources. It's got lots of good land. It has energy. That I guess the potential for this country is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, and that's I think a lot of people noted, you know, as the Soviet Union was collapsing in you know, 1991, that if you had to put sort of money on the table to sort of guess which of these post-Soviet republics are you know, going to be making the greatest strides towards marketization, liberalization, democratization, and all those wonderful things that we like. I think most people would have put their money on Ukraine. They were the breadbasket, as Corey Flintoff was mentioning, not only of Europe, but as the Soviet Union as well. And so, you know, agriculturally very solid. They inherited a lot of the economic might, the industrial might of the old Soviet Union was based a lot in Ukraine. The energy infrastructure, the physical infrastructure, they had, you know, they even had nuclear weapons for a time before giving those up. So it seemed like they had all the pieces in place, but a lot of the...
The corruption, the
sort of the bureaucratic infighting, I think that both of those things sort of compound the issue. And there is quite a bit of corruption to be had, not only at sort of the high levels of the Timoshenkos, but it goes, you know, throughout the entire stratum of I guess, Ukrainian politics. And I've felt quite a bit of it, you know, just sort of on a daily basis when I used to live in Kiev.
Do you think Russia wants Ukraine back?
I don't know. I don't think so. You have nationalists. You'll hear that all the time, that people will say, well, you know, that Russia can't be great unless it has Ukraine as part of it. Well, you know, we're 20 years on, and Ukraine, you know, has its own independent state, and I don't see that going away anytime soon. It's more of a question of who has greater political sway in these decisions, whether it's, again, I guess, more part of aligned with Russia and their customs union that they're building with Belarus and Kazakhstan. You know, having Ukraine as part of that would be sort of a feather in their cap, or moving towards the European Union. And as we were mentioning before, it's not as though the European Union stands to gain a whole lot from this. It's not the economic wonderland that a lot of people initially thought it would be. The other thing that I think is worth mentioning about this accession agreement is that it isn't exactly a blueprint towards European integration. It is what essentially it is a it is a blueprint for sort of the neoliberalization of the Ukrainian market. And so, if you read the accession agreement these free trade agreements, it's more about opening the doors of Ukraine to European Union capital, and so allowing
money.
Them. Yeah, and so it's all about sort of investment and sort of breaking down any barriers to the influx and I guess sort of also the exit of money from Ukraine. And so it is sort of removing those tools that Ukraine would have to protect itself, I guess, in the monetary sphere and in the financial sphere as well. Excuse me.
We're almost up on a break here, but how do you see this ending? I mean, we've got a bit of a standoff last night in Kiev.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's one of my advisors back in the day used to suggest that you know, when Dante went into the Inferno, one of the circles of hell was reserved for prognosticators who have their heads twisted around backwards, always looking back on their false predictions. So I'm always a little leery to make predictions, but you know, it's this could simmer on for days, it could simmer on for weeks, months. You know, this could be a very serious problem. And the other compounding issue that comes with this is that the longer you have people in the streets and these protests going on, it becomes less of an attractive place for foreign investments. Sure. And this compounds a lot of the economic problems that Ukraine is already facing.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about some of the conflicts and confrontations in Ukraine. And again, our guest, Mark Lawrence Schrod. And we're going to be talking about his new book after this very short break called Vodka Politics. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Policy Studies that prepares students to take leadership roles in developing policies to address important issues impacting our communities. Students can choose from food and agriculture, sustainability and environment, or community and international development. More information about a Master of Arts in Policy Studies is available online at delval.edu/grad.
British actor Michael Sheen played David Frost in the film Frost Nixon and Prime Minister Tony Blair in The Queen and two other films. On the next Fresh Air, Sheen talks about those roles and playing sex researcher William Masters.
We are doctors, and I simply want to answer the question, what happens to the body during sex?
Sheen stars in the Showtime series Masters of Sex. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
awesome ride, dude.
It doesn't go fast. It's not racy in any sense. But every corner of this car has memories for me.
From Detroit to Tehran, a man who designed Chryslers falls back in love with the wheels of his younger days. No GTO, Iran's humble Paycon gets respect. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We've been talking about the protest and the roots of the protests in Ukraine. And again, our guest is Mark Lawrence Schrod. He's assistant professor of political science at Villanova University. And his research specializes in the politics, the foreign policy of former Soviet states. Ukraine, of course, a former Soviet state. He's also the author of a new book. It's called Vodka Politics, and it's subtitled Alcohol, Autocracy, and the Secret History of the Russian State. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We read about you. You had a piece in the New York Times a couple of months ago about this vodka politics idea. What do you mean by that when a book is titled Vodka Politics?
I just thought it was an interesting way to look at sort of the broad sweep of Russian history, sort of through the bottom of a vodka bottle, as it were. It's kind of like beer goggles for Russian history. But I guess unlike beer goggles, when you put on sort of this lens of vodka politics, a lot of the different elements of Russian history, not only its current state, its Soviet history and I guess pre-Soviet history, actually become clear. You can get a little bit more understanding about things like the roots of corruption in the old Russian Empire and how that trickles down even into the post-Soviet countries like the Russian Federation and Ukraine as well.
And when you say vodka, you mean vodka.
Right.
It's not a metaphor for something else.
No,
it's really about vodka.
It's about people getting drunk and what the you know, authorities do about that, to what extent that has been sort of an element that has been part of Russian statecraft going back literally hundreds of years. And this is something that, you know, people look at Russia and its vast history, and you see all these big revolutions. You know, you have the revolutions in 1917, you have them again in 1991, and you think things are completely changing. But vodka is one of those things that seems to be constant throughout, and the ways in which it is not only sort of a central keystone to state finance for all those different times. But it's also sort of helps us to understand sort of the anemic state of civil society in Russia in particular. That's, you know, they didn't have a temperance activism as they had in the United States back in the day and so on and so forth. So there are a lot of different, you know, the book kind of takes a broad sweep of history, starting with Ivan the Terrible and straight through to Vladimir Putin, trying to understand not only the different personalities involved, but like the broader political dynamics as well.
And I want to pick up on that, but just one of the things that you say in this book, that the average Russian man, this would be, I guess, today, consumes 180 bottles of vodka a year. So that's about half a bottle of vodka every single day.
Right.
And that's the average.
That's this is as of about 2009. There's been an anti-alcohol campaign launched by then President Dmitry Medvedev, but it came down to about the average intake of alcohol was something around 18 liters per person per year. And so if you take out abstainers, if you take out children, if you take out women who tend not to drink as much as men, and try to translate that into actual bottles, it comes out around to about a half bottle of vodka per day for every.
It's a lot of vodka.
Average drinker, and so if you're not drinking your half bottle of vodka a day, you're falling behind. You got to catch up.
Well, does that explain the fact that there is a pretty dramatic population decline in Russia?
That's part of it, certainly, especially when it comes to male life expectancy after the collapse of communism, essentially cratered. Went down to average male life expectancy went down to around 58. In the immediate post-war, Soviet days. And a lot of people assumed that when the economy got revving again, that these demographic indicators would increase as well, but they didn't. And that's partly because the amount of alcohol that was being consumed was increasing during that time while the economy was getting better. So only recently have there been steps to try to alleviate some of these issues. And even those have been plagued by sort of the corruption and a lot of the internal political machinations of the Russian state.
In fact, one of the things that you say in the book is that over time, when you look at how vodka has been used by various political leaders in Russia, or perhaps even the Soviet Union, has been used to, quote unquote, oppress and exploit its people.
Right. And this is very, I like to think about it more in terms of the way that the states and society interact. And so for a long time, even going back hundreds of years to the old Russian Empire, it was a way of keeping the population off balance, drunk, atomized, unable to mount sort of a collective resistance to the power of the state. And you also saw that in the inner circles. I start the book off with these vignettes of Stalin's inner circle, and he liked to keep his Politburo colleagues drunk pretty much all the time. And part of that was so that they would reveal any sort of secret plots that they might have against him. So I found that an interesting parallel that Stalin had not only with Ivan the Terrible, but Peter the Great, mm-hmm. and a number of other Russian leaders on down through the years.
In fact, you say I'm not sure you're saying that the cause of the 1917 revolution was a ban on vodka, but it did kind of coincide.
Yeah, well, this is just an interesting thing that I ended up finding in a lot of the Russian archives is that even despite the fact that the Russian Empire did not have a temperance organization or widespread temperance sentiment like we had in the United States, it was actually the first country ever to go dry by decree. The problem was is that that was mostly a well-meaning symbolic gesture for Tsar Nicholas II at the time towards his great uncle Konstantin Konstantinovich, whose son died in World War I, who was a temperance convert. So he essentially makes Russia go dry by decree. Problem being is that at that point, alcohol revenues constituted fully one-third of all the government revenues in the entire state. And this was as you're going into World War I. And so there's very few chances for you to slip up when you're putting when you're putting your finances together and putting the largest army in the field that had ever been seen in human history, but this sort of exacerbates the economic problems. This exacerbates all these different discontent with the Tsar, hyperinflation, all these sorts of things come. I kind of trace them back into alcohol. So.
One of the ways that we found you was you had a piece in the New York Times a couple of months ago having to do with the Olympics. It's in Russia, and the calls for the boycott of Russian vodka because of the homophobic laws that they have in that country. And you raised the question about, first of all, whether that's an effective way to protest against these homophobic laws, but also the fact that is there still Russian vodka when you trace the creation or the making and then the production of vodka, where do you end up?
Right. And it was late night. I was watching TV and people were shouting about alcohol and Russian politics. And I said, hey, I wrote a book about alcohol and Russian politics. Why am I not shouting at this point? So, essentially what I came down, and I'm an LGBT ally, broadly speaking, is that looking at Dan Savage and his vodka boycott, I thought, one, it was perfect in terms of the symbolic politics, probably unbeknownst to Dan Savage, who is kind of the driving force behind this, looking at the oppressive nature of vodka over time, and I sort of highlight some of those issues from the book. But I guess that was the upside. The downside was I didn't think it would be a fairly effective tactic to essentially switch from Stolichnaya to Kettle One.
Yeah.
Isn't all that big of a symbolic gesture. Plus, there was with any sort of protest, there's going to be risks involved. And it wasn't as though the LGBT community in the United States is assuming that risk. What I saw the risk was making the LGBT community in Russia seem even more foreign, that you have, other people doing your fighting for you and having foreign influences acting on your behalf. I saw that as being a potential risk that things might get even worse for them. So, my heart was with the boycott. Mm-hmm. I just didn't think it would be terribly effective. And as it has turned out, I guess it hasn't been particularly effective. If you look at a lot of the online sites for the boycott and whatnot, they've pretty much been shut since September. So I don't think there's much more for the vodka boycott at this point in time.
Well, let me get back to our callers. We've been covering a whole bunch of things in this hour of Radio Times, talking about the anti-government protests in Ukraine, also talking about the relationship between Ukraine and Russia, and also talking about Mark Lawrence Schrad's new book called Vodka Politics. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me see what Roma from Southampton has to say. Roma, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I hate to diverge from a very interesting thread of talking about vodka and move to another kind of fuel, to the politics between Ukraine and Russia and the gas politics, the oil politics, the pipeline politics, and the economic pressure that has been affecting Western Europe as well as Ukraine in the politics, and I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Sure. Roma, thanks for putting that on the table. Go ahead, Mark.
Sure. This has been one of the, I guess, the pipeline politics has been a big issue in East Central Europe for quite some time, that Europe has found itself reliant primarily on Russian natural gas. excuse me. And a lot of that, those pipelines go straight through either Belarus or Ukraine. Belarus seems to be on sort of a tighter leash with the Kremlin. But the problem is a number of years ago that Ukraine was mounting up these debts. And as part of the legacy of the old Soviet state, Ukraine and Belarus and a number of these other former Soviet republics got their natural gas from Russia at very discounted rates, far below what the world price of natural gas was. And so any time that there was an effort to try to bring those prices in line with the world price, this was seen as being politically motivated. This was some sort of extortion. And so when one of these, I think it was 2006, if I remember correctly, in one of these contentious debates between Russia, I should say Gazprom, and Ukraine, about these debts that Ukraine had been racking up for quite some time. Essentially, Russia said, well, if you just don't pay, we're not going to give you any more gas. And they shut off the pipelines. And this is a problem not only for Ukraine in the wintertime that you can't heat all of your houses, but it's also a problem for those downstream users, i.e. all of Europe, so Germany and Austria and France and so on, which rely heavily on those imports of natural gas that go through there. So there's a lot of pipeline politics. Russia's been trying to build what's known as the Nord Stream, essentially through the Baltic, to avoid sort of what they consider to be like these deadbeats when it comes to Ukraine and Belarus. And there's also one that's they're working on that's going under the Black Sea, the South Stream. And so there's a lot of pipelines trying to get to those markets in Europe, with much more reliable customers and bypassing Belarus, Ukraine, trying to leave them out of it altogether.
Roma, thanks for the call. Let me see what Rick from Warminster has to say. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great.
Good. Go ahead.
My question is, years ago, as a defense contractor, we conducted seminars for the Pentagon in Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Ukraine. And the subject was military and the media topics. So I'm wondering, we talk about the State Department relationship, but the continuing resolution military to military between the U.S. Pentagon and the military entities over there in the Ukraine.
And that's your question. Can you take that, Mark? Yeah, thanks, Rick, for the call. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of Ukraine and Georgia in particular, and a lot of these Armenia, Azerbaijan, less so, in terms of our cooperation with them on the military side. A lot of this has to do with trying to make inroads towards getting more aligned with NATO and being up to snuff on theirs, being part of a full membership in that at some point down the road. So there has been a good deal of cooperation there. There's also a great deal of cooperation in a lot of other areas. I know a good friend of mine that I went to grad school with is in the U.S. Department in the excuse me, not Department of Commerce, but in the energy sector. And so so there's a lot of cooperation in terms of regulating energy, in terms of military, in terms of commerce as well. So there's a lot of different areas. It's not just all, you know, government on government. There's a lot of stuff at the sub-government level going on, too.
Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me just throw Syria into the mix here. And just because we're talking about this, what appears to be kind of a standoff between Russia and the EU over Ukraine, and, of course, the U.S. A bit on the sidelines, but nonetheless trying to deal with Russia over to deal with Syria and its relationship with Russia. How does Syria factor in at all in talking about Ukraine?
I think it plays very similarly when it comes to Russian domestic opinion, public opinion about sort of the place of Russia in the broader world when it comes to foreign policy, and as they see themselves as largely a counterweight to the United States. And so maybe opposition, a lot of people have been speculating about this for some time, that Russian opposition to doing anything about Assad and chemical weapons in Syria wasn't so much about Assad and chemical weapons in Syria as it was about sort of making sure that the United States doesn't get too big for its britches. Like, and they look at what happened in Libya and see that, you know, the NATO no-fly zone and essentially the assistance that was given there went quite a bit further than was previously envisioned at the United Nations. And so Foreign Minister Lavrov and a number of people in Russia look at that and say, well, we don't want the same sort of imperial, quote-unquote, sort of overreach going on in Syria, and then if not Syria, then Ukraine, and then Georgia. You've got all these different potential flashpoints, I suppose.
Well, Mark Lawrence Schrod, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Well,
great. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And he's an assistant professor of political science at Villanova University, and his research specializes in the politics and the foreign policy of former Soviet states. We've been talking about the confrontations in Ukraine. He's also the author of a new book called Vodka Politics, Alcohol, Autocracy, and the Secret History of the Russian State. We began our conversation with Corey Flintoff, Moscow correspondent for NPR, and he joined us from Ukraine. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, podcasts. It's all there. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.